Behind the scenes we go with the young filmmaker who made a documentary about America's largest retirement community located in Florida. Some Kind of Heaven is the directorial feature debut of Lance Oppenheim. He graduated from Harvard University's Visual and Environmental Studies program just last year. His film is set in the Villages in Florida, which has more than 100,000 retirees. Some Kind of Heaven tells the story of residents' daily lives, with Lance Oppenheim's lens focused on Anne, Reggie, Barbara and Dennis. The Villages has houses and town squares designed to evoke the feeling of an American yesteryear. And there are many clubs to join and group activities. New Zealand doesn't have any retirement villages to compare with the sheer scale and amenities on offer, including 12 golf courses, 3 libraries, bowling alleys and a themed environment. Lance Oppenheim was named this year's Variety magazine's Power of Young Hollywood list. He was named on it. And Some Kind of Heaven premiered at the 2020 Sundance Festival. Lance begins by explaining what it was like to premiere at Sundance Film Festival earlier this year.
It's hard to believe it was this year. It feels like, I don't know, I feel like we've all aged like 10 years in just 1 year, but it was an amazing experience, and I still really can't believe it happened. It feels like some sort of like half-remembered dream or something.
What was the genesis of this?
It's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, most people, when they ask me how this movie came to be, they also are usually asking me, you know, why did you make this film? You're like 4 generations younger than, you know, the subjects in the film, and what drew you? And I think, you know, it's a few things. Number one, I'm from Florida, and among many other things that Florida is usually looked at, I think, one of my, you know, growing up, I grew up around so many different retirement communities. I was always kind of fascinated by sort of the transitory nature of them, kind of the way in which someone moves into a house and then, you know, it's usually the last home they'll ever move into. So I was kind of interested always in this idea of what a retirement dream looked like, or the way in which, I think specifically in America and especially in Florida, how folks choose to spend the last sort of chapters of their life. Probably when I was 12 years old, I started hearing stories about the Villages as sort of the most hedonistic of that dream, which I think in some ways, you know, it definitely is true and it applies to some folks, but it is also a misnomer for the folks in the film. But rather than being interested in a lot of the sexual sort of, you know, proclivities or whatever of the people who lived in the Villages, I was much, or even the political leanings, I was much more interested in just the very fact that a place that was designed to sort of evoke a specific spirit of the American dream that kind of came from maybe like, you know, the boomer generation, was being lived so fully and being actualized in such a spectacular Truman Show like way. You know, it seemed like people were just completely kind of immersing themselves and descending into some sort of vision that reminded them of their youth. So I was really interested in going there and living there and understanding what exactly that was. And, you know, I think that was sort of the interest initially, looking at this sort of utopian like retirement community. But after being there for so long and living there for almost, you know, 2 years, the film became something else. And I think the film kind of became something that much more personal to me, at least, kind of exploring a lot of the questions that I myself was asking in my own life as a, you know, 23-year-old, but, you know, questions about how, you know, how I guess when you're at that age in life, when you're in your 70s or 80s, you know, this may seem like not so out of the ordinary for some, but to me, I was kind of fascinated in seeing folks whose lives were still really very much not figured out, and kind of the painful beauty in attempting to try and continue to become or try to continue to figure out yourself. Even if, you know, even like towards life's final chapters. So that's sort of where it started from and then where it kind of landed.
It's been described as Disney World for retirees, which helps us envisage it visually. Your referencing the Truman Show also helps us have this sense of almost like a painted reality, right? A painted world.
Yeah.
You meet four residents, though. We meet four residents in this film. And how do they fit with, as you say, the expectations of the people living there and their experience there?
Mm. Well, you know, I think part of what I discovered in living there and living and just spending as much time as I did, and I think this is also sort of an approach that I try to apply when I'm going into communities that are not my own and experiencing the lives of others. I try to look at the extremes to kind of understand the mainstream, right? And in the villages, I do think this sort of Disney-fied experience, you know, some other, I feel like some folks who watch the film or even have heard of the villages before may think of, you know, the community as a much more ominous place, I guess, in how positive it is. It kind of almost reminded me, at least when I first got there, as you know, sort of the scenes of something like the Stepford Wives or something. But I think the more time I spent, again, it became something, you know, I grew to understand why I think people were attracted to live the way they did. And in understanding that or starting to try and understand it, I had met four different people who all sort of didn't really fit into that fantasy in some ways. I'm sorry for continuing to use the Truman Show metaphor, but it almost seemed like I was, you know, a lot of the folks, the four folks that are in the film, their Truman Show boat that they were all in kind of like hit the wall, and they were starting to sort of see through the fantasy and see through sort of the prepackaged kind of optimistic vision that this place had to offer. And to me, you know, I think, to make an expose on a place, I'm not really interested in that. I'm more interested in sort of the inner lives and the dreams and the attempts at fulfillment that folks who weren't so happy there, who were in this kind of hangover of a fantasy, were experiencing. So you know, the film ended up becoming something that's much more of a movie that looks and examines the problems, the very real problems that folks experience there. Even if it's in a very hyper-real, fantastical setting, and that there's something kind of, you know, even thinking of movies like The Florida Project, which I think does the same in a narrative context. Those were things that I was kind of interested in trying to make a cinematic journey for an audience member as well.
So let's meet them, if you don't mind, and tell us a little of how you came to know them and how you came to learn more about life from their lives. The couple, Annie and Reggie, married nearly 50 years. And what happens in their time living in the villages?
Well, I think what happens to them, you know, in some cases it's a very specific thing. Reggie is a very eccentric person who is extremely, I think over the course of almost 43 years of marriage, when you meet them in the film, they've grown apart in some ways. They don't talk as much anymore and prefers to sort of do some of the activities that, like pickleball, which, you know, for example, or kind of belonging in clubs and things that, you know, sort of make up the common experience of someone who lives in the villages. Whereas her husband, Reggie, is more of, he's someone who believes in kind of these new agey spiritualist values, and one of them kind of includes experimenting and dabbling in psychedelic drugs. And as you kind of watch over the course of the film, this ends up becoming something that is more of, you know, that isn't just a quirk or something that makes the two eccentric. But it actually leads to real problems and legal problems and real deep questions of, you know, how long and how much longer can Anne sort of attempt to endure the things that Reggie is putting through, you know, putting her through. But again, you know, even if that problem, and this is something that I was really interested in, is very specific to their relationship, I think the ways in which they handle it, the ways in which both of them sort of navigate and debate and explore the possibilities of what love can look like and what love needs to do at that age, and the problems in marriage and the problems in being with someone for that long and the distance you grow, you develop with the person. Those are all things that I think are fairly common in the villages specifically, but also, you know, anywhere really. And I'm very fortunate and grateful that both of them, Reggie and Anne, let me and, you know, my crew into their lives the way they did.
So it's almost like a midlife crisis in your 70s.
Yeah.
Exactly. Perhaps brought on, as can happen, by a change in environment, and particularly in an environment where, I mean, can you describe it? Is it like just everything is on tap and everything is predictable? Is that the kind of environment that can set someone off into a bit of a rebellion?
I think so. I mean, you know, I personally, and when I first met Reggie, I was really fascinated by him because he just was so utterly different than every single person around me. In some ways, it was like he was providing, you know, obviously his view of reality is kind of mediated through different substances and whatever. But I also felt like he was providing a fresh dose of just something else, a really fascinating and interesting way to look at what it's like, you know, to experience and deal with living in a really constructed environment all the time. You know, Reggie was one of the few people I met that was just so aware of everything that was going on. He didn't really have necessarily a problem with it, but I think he preferred to exist the way he did. And, you know, while still enjoying his life from a comfortable remove. But you know, in a lot of ways, I sympathize, and I think, you know, that's one of the things we try to do with the film. I think it's very easy to point and look at someone like Reggie who's going through something, the drugs and everything else may lead kind of to different problems psychologically going on. It's easy to look at a person like that and say, hey, that person's wrong for doing this. That person's wrong for putting their spouse through all this stuff. And, you know, you're certainly, you know, I guess my job and my experience and my relationship with both Reggie and Anne was not to paint that kind of view, the views that Reggie has as, you know, as wrong. I was more interested in sort of exploring the, you know, what does forgiveness even look like? What does, where are his values? Where is Anne in the priorities of his life?
What about Barbara? Now, Barbara's a widow, and her story?
Yeah. So Barbara's a widow who, when we first met her, her husband, was very sick. And he unfortunately passed away pretty early into when we were filming and kind of trying to figure out what exactly the film was going to be. Barbara is a spectacular. She has something again that I also just kind of immediately when I first met her, it just jumped right out to me. I mean, she works. She's one of the few people I met who still works a job. She works at an assisted living clinic, and she also is someone who is just trying to navigate the world without her life partner, someone she moved to the villages with because her late husband, wanted to move there. So now she's sort of stuck in this place. She doesn't have enough money to move back to her home in Boston. And she has no friends, she has no sort of bearings, and she's just trying to understand what it's like to remake a life for the first time. So with her, you know, I mean, in some ways it was, I think, an experience that I think a lot of people, including myself, could really connect with. It almost seemed like the way in which you make friends, you kind of find your clique, that you find your club, you find, you know, you go and you have your meet cute with a man, like all of these things felt like almost, a very innocent, innocuous kind of return to learning how to romance and learning how to exist as an individual. And I think, you know, the through line of the film in some ways, which is something I didn't even intend to really do, but I think develops from the folks we followed, is it's a film about relationships. So with Barbara, you know, with Reggie and Ann, you have a married relationship. How do you maintain the love, the fragile respect and trust that you have in someone? With Barbara, you're seeing someone who is dealing with grief, but is also dealing with themselves for the first time in a long time. And how do you kind of deal? How do you find and figure out a way to deal with yourself authentically in a world that some may say is so inauthentic, that is kind of a plastic sort of you know, snow globe of America? And then of course we have Dennis.
Yeah, let's meet Dennis, please.
Yes, and so Dennis is kind of the wild card in a lot of ways. He represents something that I don't think is really part of the norm and the villages at all. And for that reason, I just was so, you know, Dennis is a man who drove from California to Florida on an expired license. He's 84 years old. He lives in a van. He doesn't actually own any real estate in the villages. And he moved to the villages for the explicit purpose of trying to find a wealthy widow that he could move in with and essentially provide, you know, what he calls handyman work. But what he really means is he just wants to sort of be, you know, find a companion he can spend the rest of his days with, that doesn't drive him so nuts. And I was sort of like, you know, when he was telling me all this for the first time, I was like, you know, you kind of sound like the jock from high school who never grew up, you know, someone who just is kind of like almost like a recent post-pubescent boy who's obsessed with women, but maybe even more so obsessed with himself. And seeing this person who is 83 years old, who was living in a van and was chasing women the way he was talking about and the ways he was talking about, I was so endlessly fascinated by that. In some ways, it just kind of, again, reinforced this idea that, you know, we never quite, you know, grow up in a way. You know, you may grow older, but you may not necessarily grow wiser. And I thought, you know, how terrifying of an idea, but also how kind of emboldening as well, that, you know, you don't have to have your entire life figured out. And I think there's some solace that hopefully the film can provide in seeing these kinds of stories.
How did you go about the access and getting enough time with people to really get a sense of their stories and for them to open up and give you a sense of who they were? I mean, practically, what did this involve as a documentary maker?
Well, I mean, for one, you know, when I first went to the villages, I didn't know anybody, and I essentially was scouting, you know, I was trying to find subjects off of Airbnb because I realized that some folks in the villages actually rent out rooms in their home. So initially I was going around town. I was getting myself invited to as many different clubs and activities. Sometimes I wouldn't even get myself invited. I just would show up sort of unannounced. And from that kind of, from those experiences, I met Barbara at the acting club, for example. She was really interested in acting, and I was, you know, to myself, I was like, if I'm going to find anyone who wants to be in a film, who would make the time for me to be, you know, to involve themselves in a film, they probably would be interested in acting. So that was that. But, you know, more generally, I think the thing that we never intended to make a feature length film. I was intending to actually make a short film. This was initially my college thesis. And I was also sort of on the hook to make a short documentary after pitching one to the New York Times. So I was always thinking of this as a short-term thing that would never really materialize into something deeper or, you know, that went longer. But I think that the beauty of filming and how our process kind of evolved, we just couldn't, you know, we once we met the folks who were in the film, we couldn't stop filming with them. So much stuff kept happening in their lives, and they were so, you know, gracious in involving us in those things, even though those things may have been difficult. And I think another part of that process was also the way in which we were making the film. You know, this isn't sort of your usual traditional talking head documentary, our ambition was to make something that was a lot more immersive, that almost could the audience could engage with in sort of the ways that they would maybe engage with as a fiction film. And on a process standpoint, you know, the making of that kind of thing is much different. You're not, you know, a fly on the wall as much, you know, if the camera is, you know, a foot away or inches away from the subjects, and you're getting these really intensely personal and intimate close-ups. And I think, you know, what we ended up having to do was we ended up kind of embracing the artifice of reenacting certain things that may, you know, conversations that may have happened or, you know, that were happening before our very eyes. But sometimes it was a little bit, we were shooting with one camera. It was almost in some ways finding truth through recreations and almost the performances that every everyday people would be playing. You know, everyday folks were playing almost and recreating moments and playing themselves to some degree. I think that's essential, especially true for Barbara, who I think, you know, is just so expressive with her face. When you ask her, Barbara, you know, you think about the thing that you just were telling me about in an interview. Let's just put you in that mindset. It was almost kind of like acting, but based in truth and based in these real emotional moments that were happening. So I think, you know, from a process standpoint, what that made us do, it made us, you know, we had to be much more upfront and honest and truthful about what our intentions were with every scene we were shooting or every single sound bite we were going to use. And the beauty of working in that way, when we finally screened the film for the subjects, everyone was sort of, you know, it felt like we all were collaborators in making a film rather than the usual, you know, documentary subject kind of relationship, which, you know, sometimes subjects can feel like they've been used or deceived or whatever it is. I wanted to make something that was rooted in something far different, that everyone felt like they could have had a role in playing or a creative sort of component to what we were doing. So that was sort of the way we, you know, I think obviously time affords trust. But I think it also is, this is a great testament to the folks I was working with, my crew. You know, we all became something sort of like a family with our subjects, and we would eat dinner with them and drink with them and party with them when applicable. And it was a really beautiful experience. I'm very sad. It's honestly, I'd love to go back and film some more.
What did you learn personally, not just professionally, but personally,
sure,
from this rather unusual project for a guy who's in his, you know, early mid-20s? What did you come away from having learned?
Well, I mean, for one, there's a few things, you know. I think for one, I find it somewhat life affirming that a lot of the things I'm thinking about right now, my existential crises that seem to happen on an everyday basis, those don't stop. You know, in some ways, that's terrifying. That there are certain things in my life and in most people's lives that will never be completely answered, questions that go unanswered, conflicts that persist, desires that go unresolved, you know. But I'm also, I find that very beautiful in a way. And you know, I think, you know, in making this film, I initially, you know, I remember everyone was always saying this is a film about old people being crazy. And I was, you know, I very much wanted to push back on that. This isn't a film about elderly people. It's a film about people. And I think that's something, I know while it may sound trite, that is something I also am so glad that I had this experience, you know, to make friends with someone who is, you know, with people who are just from lives removed from my own. I think another thing I learned too is I don't know if I ever really want to retire. If I even have the opportunity, if one day that comes. And you know, the other thing too, it's crazy. You know, the film premiered at Sundance on January 26th, which happened to be my birthday. It also happened to be the day Kobe Bryant and his family and his loved ones who were on the helicopter that crashed with him died. And I thought to myself, again, you know, this is a film that follows people who have had the gift of old age, but not everyone gets to have that gift. And if you do get that gift, you have to use it in ways that makes sense to you. And I think, you know, in the sort of final moments of this film, and Reggie's wife says something that really resonates with me, which is that, you know, the things that may have bothered you when you're younger, they don't bother you, or at least they don't bother her as much as they do anymore. There's just not enough time that they have to deal or just be bothered by those types of things. So I don't know. I think, you know, there's quite a few things. I think there's some level that I totally understand this sort of blissful ignorance that can kind of involve one's decision making when they want to go live in a place like the Villages. But also, I think even calling it blissful ignorance is sort of I think it somewhat makes it sound like I'm being skeptical. I actually think there's a beauty, maybe unintentional beauty to that kind of thing, you know, although it could be dangerous as well.
What are your ambitions for this career? You're off to a flying start. We should say that Some Kind of Heaven was produced by Darren Aronofsky, so I understand from reading that you were sort of cold calling him, keeping in touch, sort of pursuing contact with him for something like 5 years. So clearly you've got an ambition, a persistence and a plan for the kinds and the quality of work you want to do. What do you want for your career?
Who knows? I think, you know, I have a lot of ambitions to kind of make a whole lot of different kinds of films. I'm interested in continuing to make documentaries, of course, but I also am interested in making fiction films and exploring that avenue of thought. Especially in this time, I feel like we've all been granted a lot of time to think and spend a lot of time with loved ones, but I've also been thinking and writing quite a lot as well. So I'm hoping at the very bare minimum just to continue to make films. And if I am able to, then hopefully there will be a whole lots of different kinds of stuff that stories I'll be able to tell, hopefully in the near future.
Lance Oppenheim, fairly new graduate, but this documentary has just captured people's imagination, set in the Villages in Florida. More than 100,000 retirees there. Some Kind of Heaven, it's called. It premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival.